You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today it's the turn of the Pyjama Men. This is another live show recorded at the Gilded Balloon at this year's Edinburgh Festival with a sketch double act who are among the, if not the highest ranking sketch act in the Western world. I don't know, I'm making ludicrous claims here, but I can back them up. In 2011, their show, I forget the name of it, I think we mentioned it on the podcast. They've got very wobbly, unknowable names for their shows, so forgive me for not remembering them. They're sort of deliberately oblique. But in 2011, their show was the highest rated, the best reviewed show at the entire Edinburgh Festival. So I hope you enjoy this. Shanoa and Mark were very kind coming along on their day off. And I'm really pleased with this interview. I think you'll certainly, in comparison to recent episodes, it's a lot slower, a lot more thoughtful. It's a bit of a slow burner. But I think throughout the hour, all three of us kind of uncurl and we get some really interesting insight into their dynamic, into their creative process, and into the challenges of being such a successful festival, global festival based act. So this is Shanoa and Mark, the Pyjama Men. Thank you very much for coming. I should point out that the Pyjama Men, Shanoa and Mark, are drinking beer because they've agreed to come and do this show on their day off, which is worthy of another round of applause, ladies and gentlemen. It's excellent work.
We got away with that one, didn't we?
Yeah. Is it your day off? I didn't check. Yeah, maybe not.
No, it really is. It absolutely is our day off.
How has the festival been going? How's your show this year?
Great. Here, you say some words.
Yeah, how's the festival been going? It is, you know, it's amazing. I love this festival. We started our career here, really. I mean, we used to tour Canada a lot, and we always heard that we had to do the Edinburgh Festival, and we came here in 2004, and we've kind of been coming here ever since. And it's just, yeah, the festival, it's been going great, and I feel like it's one of the most dynamic things we get to do in the year.
Okay.
Like there's so many different things going on, and so many other comics you get to meet, and we're performing in this old church that's all stone and gothic and exciting to be in. Yeah, I don't know, we're having a great time.
Sure. And how is the how does the Edinburgh Festival fit into your performing year? Do you make a show elsewhere and then bring it here, or is this a place where you create new material? How does it work in your year?
Kind of both. It's nice to kind of know what you're doing when you get here, because it's a very competitive festival, and you really want to be on your A game. Mm-hmm. So we try not to open a show in Edinburgh.
Sure.
We have done that, but it definitely puts the fire under if you want to open something here. So. Yeah, we kind of play it safe and go back to our friends in Albuquerque and perform for them, and then get on an international circuit that starts in Australia and kind of move around.
Okay. Okay. So just it occurs to me just that there may be one or two people here who aren't familiar with your work. Could you describe in your own words what it is that you do? Because you are quite unique. I don't really know of any other act like yours.
I bet there's more than one or two people who are not familiar with that. If you've heard of us, maybe, I don't know, applaud or something? Or if, See?
Thanks. You're the only ones of my guests that have tested that theory. Yeah, Some people I just think are interested. I mean, it looked like it was going to rain.
Right.
So that's fine too.
So we're obviously a duo. We play a lot of characters. And we create, basically when you go and watch the show, it looks like just sketches kind of loosely weaved together. But as the show goes on, we reveal that they're all part of the same story. And
sure.
It comes to a nice close at the end. But mm-hmm. Really, we're just trying to be funny.
Sure. And the name Pajama Men is derived from the fact that on stage, the two of you wear pajamas. You don't use any costumes. You don't use any props, maybe a couple of chairs. And often a live musician.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, it seems like your work has incredibly high production values whilst having nothing. Do you know what I mean? It's got a real, and people who've seen it will know, it has a real sense of quality because you are, there don't seem to be any missteps or fudges. You're kind of, you seem very in control. It's very poised. You seem very virtuoso in your mime and in your comedy and in your improvisation. You're looking at me confusedly, but I think that's
nice.
True.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
So you're stepping in and out of lots and lots of different characters, having different conversations, stuff like that. So how is this show different to any other you've done? Or is this a sort of a rolling process of your style? Is this the next piece in your style, or are you trying anything new in the show?
Yeah, I think we are trying new thing. I mean, it is an evolution of how we've been doing our shows. When we first began, Shanoa said we were touring the Canadian Fringe Circuit. So
sure.
There's fringe festivals kind of all over the place. This is just the first and biggest year.
Okay.
Only that. But across Canada, we toured these shows that were, there was no real through line except for just kind of trying to make kind of a climactic arc of,
sure.
Kind of had this sort of revolution of, a resolution of sort of comedy. We just sort of keep the ball in the air.
Yeah, okay.
But we really got into writing stories and plot and that kind of thing a few years ago with our shows. And so as we start writing more and more of these shows, they become more and more story driven.
Okay. And when you say writing, how do you go about making your material? What's the starting point for creating one of your shows?
Well, we improvise a lot, but we kind of approach it from a few different ways.
Okay.
We do just kind of go into a studio and improvise and take on characters and have no real rules. So we'll have days that are just totally loose, going wherever, sometimes nowhere.
Okay.
And mine material, and we have a couple of notebooks lying around, and anything that we think is interesting or
okay.
funny.
And that's just the two of you in that room at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we used to try to kind of like record ourselves and then and then watch it back, but that takes like, then you're kind of rehearsing twice. Like you do it,
sure,
and then you
sure,
have to
okay.
like watch it all again. So we just like run over to the side and write things down.
Okay. And is that quite a disciplined sort of a process? I think from amongst a lot of the stand-up comics that I speak to, and I know of my own experience as well doing stand-up, I find it very difficult to try stuff out in a room on my own. That I've tried that as a process, but do you feel like idiots standing there, the two of you, or does the presence of the other help you?
You'll just. Get in. You've tried getting into a room and just be like by yourself.
Yeah.
So I. Well.
Yeah. Absolutely. I'll try anything to try and create new material. Absolutely. Yeah. So like, there's a stand-up technique called rant and rave where you set mm-hmm. a timer and you record you just talking, mm-hmm. About a subject, in an excitable kind of way, whether you're violently for or against something.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that sort of process, but it's very difficult to do because you feel like a dick.
It
sounds like it.
Well, no, I mean, I've definitely like tried that just by myself kind of stuff before.
Sure.
And I find it really, it's very weird. Like it's a strange way to do things, but we have each other, mm-hmm. Kind of as an audience at the same time.
Okay.
And so as we're improvising or whatever, if one of us laughs, just quickly just jot that down.
Okay.
And then, at the end of the day, you kind of look at the notes, or maybe we'll probably wait a couple of weeks, but we look at these notes, and half of them or unsalvageable in, in this way of just like, well, that was just kind of an improvised,
funny
like,
in the moment,
funny in the moment type of thing that can't really work as a planned joke, or else it'll just fall flat. So we lose a lot of kind of material that way. But then, you know, the stuff that that is there, that remains, is what we start, you know, working with.
Sure. So how do you know, what is it about something, how do you make that decision as to which stuff remains? Like, well, can you give us an example from your current show of a piece that was created like that, and what it was about that stuff that made you go, ah, we're onto something here?
An example. I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's just jokes, I guess, that sometimes you're like, okay, that's a joke. You're like,
sure.
That seems like pretty structured, you know? I don't want to tell you our jokes.
Well, I mean, that's definitely a feature of your work, is that you've got like really good one-liners kind of buried in between, you know, dialogue that sort of seems inconsequential. I remember seeing you at the Pleasance 2 years ago. I don't remember which year it was. And you had a joke that I don't think anyone else noticed. I shouted with laughter and everyone turned and looked at me like I was ruining the show. You said something about... I left a gun in my drawer loaded, so I can't remember if I put any bullets in it. That's a hell of a joke, man. That's a great joke.
So, like that. You did it for us. I didn't have to. That's better. That takes the pressure off. But yeah, so, and then sometimes it's just a theatrical idea, you know. Like our last show, we had these kind of masks that we created using our hands to create these big alien faces. And so you do some work in front of the mirror and you're like, okay, that's great. I'll write that down. But we kind of, like I was starting to say before, we sort of approach it from a lot of different directions. This is the improvised side. And then there's like sitting in a cafe, like really trying to hash out what the story is. Mm-hmm. Like really kind of getting down to the more of like a math problem of how can these characters link up and where are the payoffs? And the more of that little kind of connective tissue you find is great. But I feel like what really keeps our work alive is toggling between the two, because if we get too story driven, then all the funniness and surprising nature of it disappears. And if we get too wacky and loose, it just doesn't make enough sense. And I, at first, like Mark was saying, you know, we thought like, I was almost defiantly anti plot. Like, it was like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do what everybody else is doing. And you look at stories and you feel like you just hear the same stories again and again and again. And as I get older now, I have much more appreciation for story. But we initially, like when we were younger, we were like, let's just do something that's really anarchic. And then we'll have it, you know, kind of pace it out more in a musical sort of way. Like kind of the rhythm of the whole show, by the end, you would feel like that was our idea.
It would
idea.
Be satisfying.
Like, you'd be satisfied
the rhythm,
by
yeah.
the end because of the pacing was right.
Okay.
It would be the pacing of a story without a plot.
Sure.
And it went all right, you know. But now we're like really enjoying like the kind of the satisfaction that we have and the audience has when you link these things together and go, oh, look, that thing that seed they planted earlier is now, you know.
I think the show, I think the one before this one, which had was that the time travel plot? There was a time traveler going throughout it. And then this show happens. It was two shows ago. Yeah. And then this show happens throughout several different historical periods that then you work out the connection between them.
Yeah.
So is that quite a sort of a painful process to get everything to fit? You said it's kind of almost mathematical.
Painful for sure. In that it's just a really hard time to try to get the writing process. I mean, it's fun, but it's just these kind of long hours of just like, you know, we have a, you know, just like I'm sure a lot of people, you just set a deadline and you know that you have to be on stage in X amount of days. And you know, as that deadline gets closer and closer, the hours of the day get longer and longer.
Yeah.
Just in terms of how much we have to start really pushing for. It's the only way, I mean, personally, it really works because we have to, you know, you have to show something. So yeah, it's a painful process, but the, like with any show, like for this one, for example, we had a whole set of other ideas that just, as we worked through, just kind of wasn't working. And that happens all the time. We know that. And it's really funny to look at how, like, we'll be like 3 weeks out before opening the show and be like, knowing that everything we've got, like, this is what the show's going to be. But also knowing that in 3 weeks, it's going to be totally different.
Okay.
And we will have changed quite a lot of it.
Sure. And do those changes happen on stage? like the it's kind of growing on stage, or are you still, you were saying before we started talking here, you were saying that you're that it's changed since I saw it in Melbourne, this show. And do those changes happen on stage, or are you kind of running in the show for a month and then taking it away and pulling it apart and reworking it?
Yeah, the changes definitely happen on stage. It's everything. Like we'll improvise quite a bit during the show. Our favorite shows to do are ones that are where mistakes happen and we kind of run with some deal, or one of us just starts going off on some new idea and we'll just kind of take it. Like, I love those shows because it keeps us really invested in the performance. Just like 2 days ago, we were running long.
Okay.
And the people at the venue were like, you guys, so we had to, just go through and trim some stuff, but that really helps because you can kind of cut away the fat. And so we do that all the time. The show kind of expands and contracts all the time. And then we'll definitely like look at pieces that like we'll have jokes that just don't work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like it'll be like this thing that was landing really well, and then 2 weeks later it'll be nothing. And so we'll just like get rid of it, but then we'll need to like put some new stuff in.
And do you work with a director ever, or anyone being an outside eye, or do you get other fellow comedians to come and look at it? Or
not really. I mean, we're kind of a self-made operation.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it feels like maybe it'd be good to have somebody come in, but I don't know, it's tricky. I think that we're pretty generous with our work, but at the same time, it's hard to bring a director in. I mean, like when you're a double act that's been developing your own stuff for 14 years, it's kind of like, how are you going to understand our world? But that said, sometimes it's really refreshing to have an outside eye, but we don't really do that very much.
Okay.
We tend to kind of just develop it ourselves and hash it out and think about it and struggle with it and grapple with it. And the audience becomes a pretty good director with comedy. Like, if they're not laughing, it ain't working.
Yeah,
you gotta fix it. So
when you talk about a director hypothetically kind of not understanding your world, do you have kind of principles or rules, whether spoken or unspoken, about what it is you do and what it is you don't do?
Well, there's kind of a contradiction in it, I think, because we don't really ever want to do anything cliche. So we really struggle to be original. That said, we have genres in our show. They're like the Old West or film noir that are like serious cliches. And we use that as fuel. But there's, we're not topical. We don't make direct references to anything.
Mm-hmm.
So often it's, people are like, you guys are really good at physical stuff. You should do something about sports. I don't give a shit about sports.
Okay.
I don't, it's not exciting to me. So yeah, I don't know. But yeah, I guess I feel like with some of the directors that we've kind of worked with, I'm always kind of, I get resistant to kind of cliche ideas, and it seems rampant, especially in entertainment, especially when you're like trying to sell scripts and that kind of stuff, or write film and television. It's like, make it the most basic, simple idea that anyone can understand, and then you can sell that. Make it at all interesting.
Mm.
Good luck. Except for like the few shows that are actually great
that accomplish
actually
somehow managed to penetrate. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I don't know. It's a real struggle.
So what sort of sketch show? Because it's fine. I don't even really kind of put you in the same bracket as a sketch show. That's why I sort of feel like you're your own genre, and that may be because you avoid some of the cliches or the tropes of other sketch shows. What kind of cliches are you talking about that you try to avoid? What sort of other things do you see that you think, well, that's, we've got to make sure we don't do that?
Yeah, I mean, we do a lot of relationship stuff, but it's never like straight up like, women are crazy and men are stupid. Like, we just don't do that. And, we don't do like a ton of jokes about like periods. You know, like we don't do jokes about
how... Is that a trope of sketch comedy? Is that?
Yeah, it is. And like we don't do a bunch of jokes about like, oh, well, if you play sports, you're just a bunch of gay guys rolling around the mud. Like, we don't do that. That's fucking everybody's done that.
That's almost like lazy observations.
Yeah.
You mean? Yeah.
So, you know, we try to make it really surprising. And we're also kind of, we're both prone to like fantasy and stuff like that. So we're always like kind of bringing in, you know, kind of... You said to be pretentious, so
absolutely. Please do. And
We try to make it as imaginative as possible, and we try to make it new. And I think that we're trying to create a style, and we've been developing our style for a long time.
So this is the Pajama Men. I hope you're enjoying this. As I said, it is a bit of a slow burner, a bit more reflective maybe, but definitely worth sticking with. The Pajama Men are doing a very long run at the Soho Theatre coming up soon. That's 15th of October to Saturday the 23rd of November. So if you've not seen them before, or if you've not seen this show before, I cannot recommend it enough. They're so funny. They're such virtuoso performers. And I don't think anybody could fail to see it and not be moved to laughter or certainly inspired by what they do. I just think they're absolutely brilliant. So thanks to the boys for coming along for this interview, which we'll continue with in a moment. While you're on the Soho Theatre website, however, you could also book some tickets to see Nish Kumar Is a Comedian. He's on there from the 9th to the 21st of December. That's the longest run Nish has had at the Soho Theatre thus far, and I'd like to help him make it a success. You'll know if you're a regular listener that Nish is a friend of the show and of mine, and I think he's an absolutely excellent comedian, so he's definitely someone this show should be supporting. And do feel free to, now, should I say this? I was going to say, feel free to email in and recommend things like that are happening. I don't mind using... Yeah, I don't mind. I'd love to use this show as a way of promoting things I like. Obviously, it's a little bit unfair that I'm promoting Nish just because he's my mate, but he is brilliant. There's other stuff going on as well. However, I've just realised that if I open up the floodgates to, hey, why not email me stuff to promote, then that could be an error. And now I'm trying to think what I should do whilst actually talking to you. Mm-mm-mm-mm. Leave it with me. I'll come up with a system for next time. Don't email me anything. Ah, the wonderful world of comedy. So, it's talking about things spiraling out of control. The hashtag historical comedians went bananas. That's the first time I've started something on Twitter, that's then gone on to have a life of its own, where people were sort of hashtagging it to each other all over the place. Very proud of that. And ashamed in equal measure. Here are the winners. There are three winners chosen, not entirely at random. These are just three of my favourites. Mac Interesting with Marcel Lecomte de Monte Cristo. Now that's good. That's just bloody good. I don't care who you are. At Impronymous with Bonnie Prince Charlie Chuck, which I like because it's just daft. And there's nearly always, whenever we do these competitions, Rivetmaster sends in hundreds of very, very high quality entries. So this is at Rivetmaster with Gandhi Parsons. That was my favourite of his very high class crop. Well done. All three of you win points. And what do points mean? Nothing. I haven't asked you for ages to rate me on iTunes. So I'm just going to... That's an odd sentence, isn't it? Suddenly struck. Oi, rate me on iTunes. I haven't asked you for a while, but I'm asking you again now. If you enjoy this show, if you'd like to help me promote it, then please go to iTunes and put a fair, accurate and honest 5-star review next to it. I will accept 4, but no lower. Thank you very much. Do that if you haven't done that already. If you want to write a little blurb about the show and why you like or dislike it, then feel free. That facility is there for you, and it will do me some good. It'll help me promote the show and get it noticed a bit more. And finally, I'm very pleased and proud to announce that this show has cracked 500,000 downloads. I'm absolutely blown away. Thank you all so much for that. I should point out that's downloads in total rather than listeners. I'm not claiming to have 500,000 listeners, but it's still a milestone for me. I nearly said millstone. God, that's telling. And partly as a celebration of that 500,000 downloads, and partly because, bless you, a few of you keep emailing in and asking me to provide one. I'm very pleased to say that there is now a donate button on the website. This is my donate button spiel. I'll make it brief. Over the last year and a half of me doing this show, it's kind of become my thing. And I'm glad I've got a thing. I think everyone should have a thing. I'm glad this show has become your thing as well. That makes me really happy. When I think about the amount of time I spend in a car or you know, just walking down the street listening to podcasts, and I think about the amount of time I spend with those people on the shows I listen to, and I'm just thrilled to think that you might spend a similar amount of time with me and with my guests. Now, you don't owe me anything for this, and I won't try and convince you that you do. But if you feel that this show, The Comedian's Comedian, makes a difference to your art or to your business or to your life, and if you'd like to support the show, then you can go to the donate button at comedianscomedian.com and you can select the amount that you want to donate. Not everyone can afford to give me a few quid for the show every so often, but I like to think the people who can afford it pay for the ones who can't. And finally, there is a special rate for performers. You guys pay double. So think about whatever you think the show is worth, double it and bang it through PayPal. And if you've got no money, that's fine. Just do me a favour and give me a rating on iTunes. I'd really appreciate that. So, yeah, good, good. Let's get back to the Pajama Men.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So we met in high school, and after we graduated, Shanoa called me, and this, like, little did I know that this phone call I would get would be kind of like a reoccurring thing that happened for the rest of my life. Where he called me one morning and he was like, "Hey, there's an improv group audition. You want to come?" I would not have known about this. I was like, "It's 9 a.m." And he was like, "Come on and audition for this." And I just had no idea what I was getting into. But we went and auditioned for this this improv group that in Albuquerque that does not boast a comedy scene at all, let alone an improv scene. You know, it's a very small city. There's just not a lot of that kind of thing going on. But it didn't matter. Like we just wanted to do it for the fun of doing it. And so we did that. And we got into that. And that is kind of where the improv background begins and ends. It was like it was this group where the director of it was very interested in not just the comedy side of improv, but like the serious and poetic side of like doing these. And what his vision was to do these long form improvs that had kind of everything.
I've never heard of serious improv before. I've only ever known improv as a tool.
Well, there's
for
a
comedy.
Reason that you have because nobody wants to go see like some crappy scene laid out between this just isn't working. I know.
Yeah.
Great. but Shanoa and I really like tended to do comedy during this thing, and we were always on stage together. They called us the Molecule Brothers, I think, which was almost a name that we were going to take, but it was too close to some other thing.
Too close to umbilical.
Yeah, it was too close to umbilical. Yeah, brothers. Sure. That's it. Well, yeah. We were just on stage all the time together. Mm-hmm. Whenever Shanoa would go on, I'd be like, "Oh, that's my cue. Okay. I'm going to do a scene with him," because it was the most fun. Basically the director of that improv group got a book by Viola Spolin called
Improvisation for Theater.
Thank you. He just read every exercise in it, and we did that for 2 or 3 months leading up to our first performance, and it was a really great training just in terms of how to do improv. We did that, and then that ran for a little bit, and then that group was kind of off and on, and then later on, Shanoa and I, there was a late night variety show in Albuquerque run by a theater company that Shanoa was a part of at the time, called the Reptilian Lounge, that went on. It started really late, and we would always close the show by doing our bit. We were called Sabotage at the time, and we would you know, we would sign up to do it on the Saturday and we would go up the hall when the show started and just like have a couple of ideas and string them together, and then the rest would be improvised and we would go on stage at the end and, you know, kill it.
Sure.
Or not. No, it was great. I mean, it was good enough that it always felt like it was enough to make us go, this is working. Mm-hmm. And then we decided to do a 1 hour show, and again, another thing, get the call. Shanoa was like, Shanoa had gone to school at a conservatory called Del Arte in Northern California for physical theater. Yeah. And he had caught wind of this fringe circuit in Canada, and he was like, let's go and do that. And I was like, oh, it's 9 a.m. So we wrote a show to do that, and that, doing the 1 hour show, that was kind of the start. And the first time we ever performed in front of people that weren't for sure our friends in the audience was in Toronto, in the year 2000. We did a show and it was like 30 people, and Shanoa vomited on the way to the show.
Oh my god!
From nervousness.
Okay, because you'd been performing together for a long time, but only ever in front of a safe crowd.
We were 22 years old. I don't know how old, somewhere around there.
Okay.
we just didn't have a lot of experience. We always knew at least one person at our improv shows or at our late night shows and whatever. And this was like a city that's so much bigger than Albuquerque. We're from Albuquerque, and Albuquerque's a little desert town. And the place that we performed was in a little strip mall. Like, there was this kind of little crack den of a black box theater at the end of the strip mall. And we were used to that. Like, we were used to the few people that show up and be excited and come see us every week. And
sure.
We knew most of their names.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, like, being in Toronto, like, look at the buildings. I was carrying the sandwich board, because these French festivals, like, you really have to promote yourself. And I was carrying the sandwich board that had our posters that we'd made ourselves on it, and, like, just, like, brought it. And, like, I was carrying it, and I just got so nervous that I just vomited in the street, like, carrying this, like, here's our show.
Was that just the reaction, like, as in the nerves of the fear of failure, or was it that you felt like
I was excited.
Yeah, okay.
I think I was, like, really excited.
Did you feel like it was this is our ticket out of Albuquerque, we're going to go and, you know, take on the world?
I had no idea, but it certainly became our ticket out of Albuquerque, and because it worked. Like, the people showed up, and we got our first review, and it was pretty good. And,
okay.
Like, people started coming, and then we were like, we're selling tickets. We're making money. And, you know, a few years later, we were able to do it full time. You know, we kind of, the Canadian circuit was like, wow, you can actually just...
You can just go from festival to festival.
Yeah.
Okay. And were you trying to emulate, were you aware of other kind of sketch groups around at the time that had inspired you when you were younger? I mean, what kind of comedy were you into when you were younger?
I think it's kind of a blessing that we grew up in the weird little town that we did, because there weren't a lot of examples.
Mm.
You know, we kind of knew of Second City. I think Mark had a greater knowledge of it than I did. Wasn't totally aware. I just knew there was like a cool improv company in Chicago. But I hadn't seen anything they'd done, and there's no scene in Albuquerque. Like, you have to make it happen yourself there, and we kind of did. And I think that our style is more unique because we didn't have that many examples. That said, tons of people absolutely inspire us, and you know, it's not like we grew up in a complete vacuum. I guess my bigger influences are Eddie Murphy is kind of a huge one for me. And I don't think what I'm doing now is really like what Eddie Murphy was doing.
That's quite an unusual influence for a sketch person to name a stand-up.
Yeah, but he was so, like, his early stand-up, he is full of a lot of different voices and characters and really exaggerated. And I had Delirious on cassette, and I used to listen to it, like, fall asleep to it.
Sure.
Just repeatedly. I knew it by heart.
Yeah.
And I would do routines from it for my cousins and stuff, and, you know, when I was, like, 12.
Yeah.
So that definitely
UK listeners will be interested to know I did the same thing with Lenny Henry. It's a little bit less cooler, right?
yeah, I don't know. You want to talk about your influences?
Oh, sure. A ton of different stuff, I guess. When I remember watching movies like Top Secret and Airplane and like those like the Zucker brothers who do these like really just literal interpretations of things that always killed me. Like, yeah. I loved it. I would be so excited to watch those movies, and I would just be like, oh my gosh, what? How are they going to turn this around?
Like, the most insane sight gags. Like, the one I always think of in Top Secret is the German soldier falling off the battlements that then shatters.
That one fucked me up.
Yeah.
Like, I remember my sister, I wasn't old enough to go see it, and my sister went and saw it, and when she came back, I was like full of questions.
Okay.
And I was like, do they explain why he shatters?
Yeah.
And she was like, no. And I was like, my mind was blown. Like, I couldn't believe that it was just the thing.
If you've not seen the movie, there's a German soldier parading at the top of these battlements, and he falls over, and you see at the top of the fall, you see from below him go, ah, like that. And then you see him from above, and they've made a ceramic version of the guy, and they just drop it and explode it to fragments. That's funny, guys.
The effect is just amazing because this guy just jumps off a building or gets thrown off a building and shatters into a million pieces. It's just like, so like, whoa. But that kind of stuff was, and I remember my brother got me the Police Squad movies, which is what Naked Gun was based on, or, you know, followed. Anyway, I don't know what I'm saying. Anyway, it was great to see. I just loved that kind of stuff. And I think it's really apparent, like when I'm like when we're doing our stuff or I'm writing jokes or whatever, it's always really like, how can like the gun loaded thing. I mean, that's exactly
it's like, a very Naked Gun, you know, sort of police story.
It's just turning this, you know, an idea into just something completely different, and that was a big deal.
But with the one-liners like that, just to stay with that for a moment, that surely that's not something that you blurted out whilst improvising. Like those individual
I remember
jokes.
Exactly that joke. We were listening to a film noir radio play, and the half the line was in it.
Okay, gotcha.
I left a gun in the bureau loaded. And I think I said, so I don't remember if I put any bullets in it.
Yeah.
we'll do that. Like, when we were writing this show, we were watching bad movies and doing that kind of commentary thing, which is one of my favorite things to do with Shanoa. Like, it's so much fun. Like, we just sit and watch sometimes really great movies too.
Yeah.
Or like whatever. But we'll, if they're going to be bad, they have to be bad enough that it's not funny bad. Because if it's so bad that it's like in itself its own work of art, then you just watch it.
Sure.
Like, this is crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
But if it's like just kind of like bad enough, or like how do they get away with making, like who gave them the money?
Yeah.
And you're just like, then it's just really fun to, you know, just to insert lines and poke fun or whatever.
That sounds like a really fun way to make your living, like to do the creative part of it or some of the creative part of it.
Yeah.
To kind of comment up. Have you got any other sort of strategies like that?
That's like the easiest kind of, I mean, we probably do that for about 100 hours and mine 3 jokes out of it.
Sure.
Have a great time doing it.
Yeah.
But I guess, you know, it does like sort of inform things in other ways maybe, but I don't know. I mean, I always try to carry a notebook and write things down. We do this thing to each other where if we're out and one of us says something that's like a joke that you think could withstand or like that could stand on its own, then it's like, write that down. That was funny. Write it down. Like I called a skull a bowl of ideas.
You said,
I was like,
last night, you were like, I'll put that in the bowl of ideas. Otherwise known as a skull, which
which is just, you know, it's not a wildly exciting joke maybe, but it was just like, all right, I'll write it down.
Okay.
And so there's always like little things like that. If they seem like they have something to them,
sure,
try to put them in. But then kind of on the darker side of things, they're not necessarily darker, but maybe the more serious side is we also kind of confront things about ourselves in our work, and then you would never know that. Like when you watch it, you would never.
Okay.
And you can kind of tell that. Maybe, I mean, there's really obvious jokes in our show about procrastination and alcoholism and stuff like that.
Sure.
But you wouldn't know that we were like, man, let's write about this shit because these are the things that could destroy our lives, or we'll keep it going. You know.
Okay.
Before this one was like all about loss and what it means to be alone all the time. Because, you know, we live our lives on the road and we spend a lot of time solitary. And So we, you know, like I think Mark first suggested, like, let's do something where we're in a space capsule or something. So we can kind of address like what it means to just be by yourself all the time. It ended up not being like about a space capsule or anything like that.
But sure. But you could see afterwards with those things in mind, you could look back and say, oh, that idea came from
sort of
a deliberate starting point rather than just like a tombola of ideas.
Yeah.
You're trying to make work about specific, you're trying to explore specific emotions.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you're starting in a true place is good. Cause it's really, especially for what we do, it's so easy to get just to the wrong side of corny. And as soon as it slips over into like just really corny, you kind of get bad and cutesy and too many puns and just kind of turn into this thing. That's like, that's not quite a good show anymore. That's a lot of crappy jokes with no heart or anything.
Do you think your ideas of quality control are matched? Does one of you tend to be the first person to say we're bidding that? What's the dynamic between you in terms of if you're not with a director and it's the two of you, do you ever clash on, you know, we've each got one vote?
I think we really both agree on like comedy, like what is funny and what can stay and like what, like we really do. I think Shinoa, his attention to detail is greater than mine.
Okay.
So
is that because of his conservatory training?
I think maybe he went and did conservatory training because of his.
Okay, like, the other way around. Yeah, gotcha.
But I think that if I can get something past Shinoa, I'm always like, yes. that's gonna work then.
Sure.
But I think that the reason why we work well together is all down to just a common worldview and understanding of what we think is cool and not cool.
Sure.
Or whatever, you know. Sure. like what, you know, if we didn't have that, it would just be, you know, it'd be very, very hard. Mm-hmm. So yeah,
I feel like we really complement each other in that way, like, because Mark's a very lighthearted person. Mm-hmm. And I'm not. I'm angry and upset all the time. And
what are you angry and upset about?
Well, if I knew, I'd fix it, maybe. I want more. I want more out of myself. I set a high standard and I can't reach it. You know what I mean?
Okay. It's like, yeah, sure.
And Mark's a lot more bubbly and fun. And I also think that sometimes I get too intense about my ideas. And Mark's like, what if we do this ridiculous thing? And that turns into the thing that's like the most memorable thing in the show.
Sure. Okay.
So I can overdo it sometimes with that stuff and like try too hard and be just too desperate about it. And then it's like, oh, you can actually just let it breathe a little.
Sure.
And it'll be a lot more fun.
I used to work in a double act in the street from about 97 for 5 or 6 years. And I can really relate to being that one in the double act. I had my partner, Noel, my best mate, who we did street shows and juggling shows together. He was always the person that would say, hey, it's okay. Let's just do something silly. It's fine. It doesn't matter. And I was the one kind of going, no, but I've got my ideas and I have to get this stuff across in my juggling show. Do you know what I mean? And I just think it's interesting, the dynamic for this relationship to have lasted as long as it has, that there's obviously a lot of love between you for each other and for the work you're doing. There's not a question at the end of this. I just wanted to go, I totally respect. Yeah, I totally get that. Isn't it great that you've got someone who can sort of cheer you up and get you out of it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, there's also, I don't know. Yeah. Mark can kind of breathe like this, silliness into things. I think I'm repeating myself, that just, yeah, it really keeps the ball in the air. I think I have a propensity to go too intense, and you know, I like to play dark villainous characters. And
sure.
I like to get really crazy. And if you don't have somebody being cute and funny next to that, you're just looking at a fucking crazy guy up there.
Sure. And
like, you kind of need the balance. You kind of need that balance.
Sure. And do you, I mean, how do you feel about your end of that relationship? Do you feel like you're helping Shinoa from not, you know, going sort of too far?
I don't think of it that way. I don't think I'm like, good thing I'm here. Like,
sure.
this would be really weird if it wasn't for me. No. I think that, you know, on the other side, yeah, it's so nice to have like really like that artistically like driven, like just, there's just nothing it just it's at a very safe place to know that there's no, like, just the filter that he has.
Sure.
You know, anything that gets through that is quality in my estimate. You know, like, and so it, like, running things by or like you know, doing a show, and he's like, I think we should cut this or do that, mm-hmm. and we, you know, we'll argue about certain, like, whatever minutia of, like, what we're dealing with. You know, mm-hmm. it's just the way the process is. But, you know, if I have an idea and he's like, oh yeah, I'm like, oh, that was.
Oh, must be a good one.
A good idea.
Yeah,
look,
sure.
At me. Like, I didn't have to like you know, bring out like the seven like arguments I had in the back, sure. of my, like, sure. I think we should do this. Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah.
And so are those the exception or the rule? I mean, do you argue on things? Are you sort of trying to do you ever have to try and win over the other one to your idea?
Yeah, for sure. I remember we did a show where I was doing this cute thing. Yeah. Shows, yeah. Which, yeah. If you guys are just like, that looks stupid. And yeah. That's what he brought to.
That was one of my favorite bits of that show.
I was totally wrong.
Totally. And that's one of those bits that everyone I know, I saw that with a big group of friends, and we still do that to each other.
Yeah.
You know, that's a really memorable.
So that was a pretty important lesson for me. Because I was like, that's so stupid.
Yeah.
Like, I just didn't. I was like, what are you doing? You're just being, oh, I'm so cute. Like, fuck you.
Yeah. And it never
and
resolved.
It just it killed. Like, it really, like, it really, like, people like cute things. Like,
yeah.
And it really landed. And now, like, that, I don't, like, I have a whole relationship with that thing now. Yeah. Like, it travels with us. So, yeah. Yeah, and it's great to be wrong about things like that and go, oh, yeah, not everything, like I was saying before, not everything has to have this kind of intensity. You can go, I'm so small, and that's enough. Maybe that's great.
Sure. And what I really liked about that was it never resolved. We never really found out what the cute
what it
thing was.
Yeah.
I thought that was good. I mean, this is going to sound a ludicrous word, but I did think it was quite brave. Like, artistically, it had integrity to not reveal what that thing was.
Right.
And I think that's part of your quality control. Do you know what I mean? It's not all there on a plate. It's not all spelt out. And I think that's something, I mean, that's one of the things, I hadn't realized this at the time, but apparently your show last year at Edinburgh was the best reviewed show in the whole of the festival in terms of stars per review.
Yeah, we did an improv show last year that
was not the best reviewed show. Okay, sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
that wasn't the Last
Stand of Reason.
The one with the cute thing is called The Last Stand of Reason. The one in the middle of no one. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And so, does that create a weight of expectation when you're getting such fantastic reviews? You were nominated for Newcomer on your very first trip over here. You've been getting better and better and better. Do you find yourself thinking, okay, we've got to bring another show next year? How are we gonna keep the rate up? How are we gonna?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we deal with is just the being compared to ourselves,
sure.
kind of problem.
Okay.
That I mean, I don't it we've been talking about it a little bit. It just in terms of, like, you know, we're evolving, I would like to think. I think we're getting better. I remember talking to Shinoa like 10 years ago and saying in a bar in Blue Lake where he went to school and saying, I want to, like, 10 years from now, look back at myself and think I was stupid.
Yeah.
You know, okay. Like, I still want that. You know, yeah. I still want to be like, how much I've grown. And I believe, I'm happy to say that I think that's happened. You mm-hmm. know, I don't think of that guy 10 years ago as being stupid, but like how did, like, we were doing that?
Sure.
Like, why was that allowed, you know, on stage or whatever? Like, that's, there is a big expectation, I guess, but it's mostly, I don't know. We're doing work that we find, like, worthwhile, like this is what we want to do this, and we'll get these reviews, which I rarely read. We'll get these things like, same old, they're doing their thing,
yeah.
You know, and it's like, yeah, we're doing our thing.
Yeah.
Like, this is our thing that we're doing, you know, and it's this negative thing, like why don't, like, what do they want? Like, are we supposed to, like, throw all this stuff away and like come back and be like, and now a juggling show.
Sure. Like,
what are, so I think that's that kind of happens. Go
ahead. Yeah, I mean, I think I'm just kind of going to repeat Mark a little bit, but it is a little frustrating, but I mean, I guess we do have to evolve, but yeah, we really do look at it as like we've been developing this style for a long time and we're just trying to improve on the thing that we do. So we haven't been trying to like reinvent ourselves. We've been trying to improve our show in the way we do it, in the way we tell our stories. And you do feel a little bit like when you're like, and not, here's more pretension, but when you're like, all right, there's a ton of different characters. There's a ton of jokes in it, like a lot. There's not a lot of filler in our show. You know, it's like
jokes. And the jokes
and
are getting better and better year on year.
In context, and they're in scenes. And, you know, we create this little tapestry of what we do. And we try to make it as unique as possible. And then, so we do that. And maybe it's similar in shape to our previous show. The story's totally different. The material's totally different. But you can see that it's our style. And we get a little stung for that. But a stand-up doesn't get stung for like, oh, there he is again with his microphone.
Sure, okay.
There he is doing that thing.
Yeah.
Like you, so that's a little bit, I think it's a little bit unfair. But that said, it's not like we've been getting killed by the press. Like we've been doing well. They just make a little comment somewhere in there that's like, but if you've seen them before, then
yeah, okay,
you'll know that you're getting yourself in, which doesn't seem like bad.
I think sometimes that accusation does get leveled at stand-up comedians, but maybe in a different way. Mm-hmm. That you kind of go, okay, this guy is on his particular bandwagon. This particular act is still hammering stuff about his personality, or this act is hammering stuff about her religion or her background. Or
yeah, that's true.
Yeah. But it's a case of whether or not the act, the individual or the group or whoever can kind of continue to grow. I mean, do you look back at previous work and like you were saying, looking back at older shows and going, what were we thinking? Is there stuff that you think of, that was a mistake, we shouldn't have done that?
No. I mean, I don't think we're that hard on ourselves. We shouldn't have done that. Shame. Bad joke. Mark does this thing where he's like, bad joke, bad, bad, bad. Take that outside. No, but you definitely, like, if we watch our old stuff, it's embarrassing to watch. You're like, oh, God.
Sure. I wanted to ask you about something I saw you guys do in the Festival Club in Melbourne earlier this year, where you were emceeing Fringe Club. And you were emceeing it. I just caught the end of it, and I didn't know if you'd been doing it all night, but you were stood next to each other with one microphone, speaking at the same time, kind of improvising what you were saying. Is that a technique you often do? Is that a thing you were trying that night?
No, that... Where did that come from? Yeah, it's a Second City game called The Two-Headed Monster, or sometimes The Two-Headed Man.
Okay.
but it's essentially like we just talk at the same time and each other and answer questions that people have for us.
okay.
And it's just really fun to do. And well, like we just did it last night in McEwen Hall. We did some bits and then we ended it with the two-headed monster. And
okay.
And it's like, especially if we're not doing a full improv show, you know, to get the audience kind of like, and now it's your turn to ask questions. And we just say that we know everything.
Okay.
I know everything as this one unit. But it's so fun because we always get, you know, what's the meaning of life? But last night there were some great questions like, how do you make a milkshake? and then it's just, it's this great kind of almost metaphor for how we work, where it's like we both have these ideas. And then there's a third idea that happens when it's the two of us talking. And I mean, I think that's just kind of what our show is as well.
Excellent. So you've had time to think. Any questions? Yes, one over here. If you ask me, I'll just say it again for the sake of the recording. Good question. Why did you why was it Mark that you were calling in particular when you were
I don't know, look at him. Like that guy looks funny. cuz actually the first time we met, we went to high school together. And I was walking past the Performing Arts Center in our high school, and there were auditions for an improv group in there, and Mark was already in there. So this was like previous to what we were talking about before. And I saw the drama teacher, and I was like, what's going on? She was like, we're going to make an improv team. And I saw Mark, and I was like, you want to audition together? And like, so the first thing we ever did, like, I'd seen him around, and I was like, that guy looks like a good guy to do a scene with. So the first thing the first interaction we ever had was like on our high school stage. And I don't know what that scene was, but it'd be great to see that. But yeah, I don't know. I guess we hit it off in high school, and already, like when we were young, our relationship before we started performing together was always in this weird sort of kind of avatar is not really the right word, but taking on different personalities, like this kind of all the time, just messing around in different voices. And so much of our relationship wasn't us talking to each other. It was us talking to each other in character voices and creating these epic soap operas, just screwing around. And yeah, it seemed like a natural thing to do, to be improvising together, and just kept evolving like that.
How much time in the year do you spend together? I mean, you seem to, if you're still doing Australian, British, Canadian festivals, other festivals presumably as well, are you on a sort of a festival circuit of going round and round the world working together all year?
Yeah, we really are.
Is that tiring?
We live in different cities. Like Mark lives in Vancouver and I live in London. And yeah, it is tiring. Is that what you said?
It is. Is that exhausting? Yeah. I mean, I've done sort of four festivals
this
year, and
it's really hard
to,
like, you know, we're both in relationships, and it's tricky. You know, like, it sucks to leave your girlfriend and be like, hey, see you in a couple of months.
Sure.
Yeah. Unless you want to fly to Australia,
yeah,
which is really far away from everything. You know? So,
but is there any way around that in your future, in your sort of plan for the next 5, 10, or 15 years? Is there a solution? Is there a way that you can make work that doesn't mean trekking and touring around the globe? Are you planning that?
I think we're kidding ourselves, but we really want to start. I think we're kidding ourselves in thinking that it's going to be like less traveling around. But, you know, I think our next big move is to make films, and I think we'll probably be just as busy and moving around just as much.
Sure.
But I like to tell myself that, like, oh, well, when we're making films, we can just come home to our ladies and do that during. And it's like the hardest, most time consuming. I mean, it's not the hardest. What a luxury to even be able to do something like that. But, you know, it's a very time consuming thing to try to do that kind of work, too. So I don't know. It's part of the deal. Like,
sure,
if you're going to do this kind of stuff, you really have to be committed to it. And it's not every element of that is savory.
Are you happy?
Yeah. No, I mean, not at all. But, like, but I find my life interesting. Happy is kind of not the right word I would use to describe myself. But I love being alive, and I'm excited about what we're doing. And, you know, but happy, I'm happy. Like, I laugh a lot and stuff like that. But I'm so tortured as well.
But I mean, this is something that the show often goes into. I've got my own, you know, tortured processes, my own anxiety about my comedy work, about all the stuff I do. And I think it's at its worst when you're tired, and it's at, you know, whenever anyone is trying to create stuff. And I know a lot of creative people in different fields listen to this podcast. One of my preoccupations is, how do you maintain, how do you keep a balance between wanting to be artistically satisfied and creative and take those risks, which inevitably involves lots of traveling and time on your own and all the rest of it, and how do you stay happy at the same time? As the bubbly one, Mark, have you got any solutions on that? Have you got an approach to that?
I don't know if I have an approach. I do feel, you know, happy. Like basically, like, I feel pretty. But that, you know, that doesn't mean that I'm not affected by the, you know, torrents of shit that happen, you know.
Sure.
Like, it's not like I'm just blissfully unaware or ignorant to the struggles of life. I feel like I have a lot of comedians that I've talked to kind of have this personality trait where I'm happiest when everyone is happy.
Yeah.
And that's hard. That's a hard kind of deal, because it's like kind of the make sure everyone's okay kind of thing. And it's not always working.
Sure.
And it's not my business either. You know, it's like, what difference does it make if this room, if this guy's struggling with something? And like, it, but I get affected by that. like very, like it's just this thing. It's been since I was a baby, you know. So that's just like this weird anxiety I have or something. Like this weird kind of like. But
is it approval? Do you think that's a very stand-up trait to be sort of to have the need for approval?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's related to that, where you know I want. You know, everyone to be like smiling and laughing, like great, everything's working out.
Sure.
And I, you know, I think it doesn't take a rocket psychologist to go
write that down. Yeah.
But to answer your question, I'm, you know, I have my own like deal with just like, it sure is hard to always be living out of a suitcase. In my suitcase, it looks like me, like it's like just frayed and like falling apart, and it's just this like thing that I look like, oh, need a new suitcase, or I need to stop traveling so much.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, okay. I'm happy. Great. Woo.
Excellent question. What do you think you'd be doing if you weren't doing comedy?
I don't know.
Besides spending lots of time with your girlfriends and having a good night.
I don't know. I feel like that changes for me like every day. You know, like I think probably the reason I went into the arts is I get so excited about so many things, and so I'm very susceptible to inspiration, and that's not always the most productive thing in the world. Like any, like I'm like, oh, look at that guy. That guy works with lions. I should work with lions. You know, it's like anything. You're like, so like I'm like this huge legend in my own mind of like I could be a politician. I could be, you know, a great like engineer. Like all these things. I sort of fancy myself an engineer, even though like I suck at math. But hey. If you need a door fixed with a plastic fork, I'm your guy. You know, like that kind of engineering. so yeah, I don't know. I think I'm in the right place in the arts because I think that I find the world interesting and I find people interesting. I'm so in awe of them, but I think it took me a while to realize like, oh, you know what, man, you're not going to be president. You didn't even go to college. You know what I mean? Like you kind of have to accept like kind of where you are, but I don't know. Maybe I'd teach. I like teaching. I don't know.
I would, really, really glad I'm doing comedy because sure. When I went to school initially to study math, incidentally, and I wasn't good enough at it. Like the people in my classes there's talented people in math, which kind of blew me away. It's like not, they weren't just good at it. They were creative. Yeah. And I was like, how does this work? And I was just good enough that it was like, I could do it.
Sure.
And then I was like, there's something I'm not just good enough that I can do it. And that's be funny. And like, and I was like, why am I doing something? And so I made this sort of turn in my university career. I ended up graduating, but like I had all these credits in all these different areas because I did a lot of physics and stuff, and then like I had, like quit that, and then got an English degree. I used to think I was going to be. Then I thought I was going to be a lawyer because my mom was like, "Maybe you could be a lawyer," and I was like, "That's a great idea, Mom." Well, I have no interest in this, I don't know. I know that I would, whatever it would be, I would be depressed because I just can't imagine. Like, I just can't imagine doing something else.
Well, you're fired.
And on that bombshell, ladies and gentlemen, we have managed to split up the Pajama Men. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for coming, Mark and Shanoa, the Pajama Men. So thank you to the Pajama Men, Mark and Shanoa, there for coming along on their day off and for being so candid as well and so open
with me during the interview. I really enjoyed that process, and I've been a huge fan of their work for years, so it was really thrilling to speak to them. Thank you, as ever, to Dan Melrose for the music, to So Television for their help in producing the Edinburgh run, and to Pete Jones on camera and James Lowy on, otherwise known as Pegs, on the desk. I was going to say James Lowy Pegs, but what I mean is James Pegs Lowy on the desk during that live show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Keep listening. You can tweet me at ComComPod or email me info@comedianscomedian.com. Go to the website. If you fancy leaving a donation, please click that PayPal button. And if you've got no money, rate me on iTunes. That seems like a sensible trade-off, but actually I'm manipulating you there into a decision, neither of which you have to do. But I'd really appreciate your support one way or another. Thanks very much for listening. I'll speak to you soon.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.